So we suggested last week that it would be possible to create artificial gravity by spinning a disc underneath the floor of a ship, right?
Yeah.
It was a really, really cool idea. Wasn't exactly positive how it worked in a pseudosciencey way, but theoretically, relativity, mass, it should work, right? There should be some gravitational force.
Yeah.
And it is true. I did some research. I did more typing after we after the podcast. And I even did some math.
Ooh.
So there's the equation E equals MC squared, right?
I know that one.
Right, exactly. I know that one. Exactly. And that's it's a wonderful equation, and it gives you the apparent mass of an object based on the energy of the object. So all we have to do is figure out what that energy is of the rotating disc.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a formula for that. It has to do with the moment of inertia and it blah-bitty-blah, right? So
right.
I went ahead and I set those things equal to each other so I could figure out kind of, okay, well, you know, assuming a certain mass and that sort of thing, how fast would this thing have to be spinning? So there's a problem, though, and that is that a particle on the outside, or a particle that's part of the disc that's spinning around, can't spin around faster than the speed of light.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah, that's true.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
What that means, though, is that it can't spin very fast.
Okay.
In terms of the amount of energy necessary to be Earth-like gravity. So you know how teachers, physics teachers in high school would be like, don't stop measuring things in weight. Weight isn't a real thing.
Right.
It's mass. Mass is the real thing. No, wrong. Mass is totally not a real thing at all. Mass is like some random property based on not just how many things there are, but what position they're in and how fast they're moving and all of this crazy stuff. Mass is really, really stupid.
Yeah.
I care about how much stuff there is, which is, I guess, moles? I guess.
Density?
No, because density is mass over volume. No, it's not tied to weight, but it's tied to mass.
Well, yeah.
Mass is just as fake as weight. So now I'm really mad because all these teachers going, stop talking about weight. Weight's dumb. Well, your replacement is equally dumb.
Yeah, I guess the best measure is just a raw count of the number of atoms in a thing.
Exactly. That's the thing that I care about. And that's why a lot of people get confused about this E equals MC squared thing, and that you go, well, energy and mass are equivalent, so we could just take energy and then convert it into stuff. No, it doesn't work. Because mass is just an attribute of things in a pattern.
Yeah.
There's no way to get stuff from energy and vice versa.
I mean, yes, there is. I don't think it's E equals MC squared exactly that provides for that mechanic, but that's how particle accelerators work. They smash things together, liquefies them into pure energy, and then we have weird particles come out of that pure energy soup, basically, that we create for a nanosecond.
All right, you're going to have to provide some source, and we're going to have to follow up on that. But on the subject of this follow-up...
Okay.
So... set the apparent mass to Earth. We want an Earth-like gravity. So we want this disk spinning underneath the ship to be the mass of the Earth.
Okay. We want the mass of the Earth to be inside the ship.
Yes. So that we get gravity, which would be awesome. Not the amount of stuff of the Earth, just the mass of the Earth. Which is kind of like weight in that it doesn't tell you much of anything about how much stuff there is.
Right. Yes.
So we can set that equal to the energy of a spinning disk, and there's a formula for that. Now, that ends up translating to, it involves the moment of inertia, which is the whole idea of a skater holding their arms out, pulling them in, spinning faster, slower, that whole thing.
Right.
The moment of inertia is related to the mass of the initial object.
Mm-hmm.
And then times the radius squared. And this is specifically for a hollow cylinder. So the bad news is, if we combine all of these equations, and my math could be wrong, but I don't think it's that wrong. we still have to make sure that a point on the disk is not making a revolution faster than the speed of light.
Because that's impossible.
Because that is impossible. So it has to be just below, and then it can be our fake gravity. So the bad news is that the initial mass of the cylinder that's spinning, its mass without taking into effect the fact that it's spinning, its mass just by virtue of being stuff,
right,
has to be about 1 trillion times the mass of the space shuttle.
Okay.
And it doesn't matter how big the disk is.
Yeah.
Because the radius, a larger radius does improve the energy, but it also means that you're traveling the further distance. The r squared happens to be in both sides of that equation. So yeah, the radius doesn't matter. The mass that I worked out was something like 1.84 times 10 to the 18th, which is larger than Phobos, the moon of Mars.
That's an absurd number of molecules.
So if you had Phobos and you got it spinning at the speed of light, then it would exert the same amount of gravity as the Earth. So...
All right. I'm still not convinced you're properly taking into account the Lorentz transformation. However, I will concede for right now, and we will perhaps follow this up in a later episode. All right,
you're going to have to do the math next time.
I will happily do the math. I will happily do the math.
But you need a small moon.
Maybe.
And
pending
then
further confirmation.
And then you basically need to, I mean, then you're also still stuck trying to go somewhere, presumably, on your spaceship, which means propelling the small moon around with you.
Well, is it propelling the small moon, or is it going to be propelling the Earth if it was spinning? Because the mass increases. Mass.
Oh, wow.
We didn't consider this earlier.
Oh, man. Yeah, if you make something that has enough apparent mass to pretend to be the Earth, then pushing that along with the spaceship is also going to be a real pain, isn't it?
Well, luckily, those are fairly easy to fit inside warp bubbles, just small Earths.
Oh, yeah.
So we're fine, just as long as we use warp drive and not EM drive.
Right, which we should be doing anyway. Is the EM drive at all, or, sorry, is the warp drive at all dependent on the mass that is moving through? I guess I'm curious. I mean, maybe we just don't know this at this point, but the energy required to create the warp bubble, is that dependent on, say, the size of the warp bubble that we're trying to create, or is it dependent on the amount of mass that we're trying to fit within that warp bubble? Because if it has nothing to do with the mass, then that's pretty awesome. That means we could send a probe wherever. It means we could send a planet wherever. We could send, you know, anything.
I'm pretty sure it has to do with size, because you just have to bubble around the object you're trying to move.
Right.
So, presumably we could push around a spaceship weighted as much as the Earth.
Well, actually...
Or the Earth.
Yeah, that was just going to say, this seems kind of... Why are we building the spaceships then?
Well, we'd have to move the sun with us, so we'd have to also encompass the sun.
Well, no, but it would be fairly reasonable to take, say, the moon, or, I mean, basically just construct something that is habitable and has enough gravity that humans are perfectly fine. It's just kind of a mini traveling Earth that can go visit places. I mean, really, if we're talking about traveling that sort of distance and we're talking about, you know, a significant amount of time, then it seems like trying to actually create artificial gravity is stupid in comparison with just creating a bubble big enough to create something that has that amount of gravity naturally.
Yeah. This also brings up an interesting question. So when the Enterprise goes into orbit around the Earth, they still have their artificial gravity on. Do they start co-orbiting a point in between the two?
Yeah, I mean, theoretically, yes. The Enterprise and the Earth should spin around each other like binary stars.
Yeah, which I don't think they ever quite showed in the show. Maybe they have a compensator for that.
Okay, so basically, if we ever do figure out anti-gravity, We can't use it to visit anywhere without destroying that anywhere.
Yes.
So we could figure out anti-grav, get a warp bubble going, visit Alpha Centauri, and then discover, hey, this is weird. The planets aren't orbiting each other, aren't orbiting the star. They're like headed towards us. Did someone tell them we were coming? This is very strange.
I mean, that is once you already get over the fact that building a warp bubble and accelerating it at a very fast speed towards a place, you build up particles on the outside edge of the warp bubble, and then you wind up irradiating where you're trying to go anyway. So don't come home if you've built a warp drive. You can go away, that's fine. Just don't come back, because you'll accelerate these like light speed particles through the Earth. And probably give us all cancer. So please don't come back if you build a warp drive. There are probably ways around this, but warp drives are just so theoretical right now that you can't really try to speculate on that.
No, but just, we can't have, we need anti-gravity, Alex. This is the next problem that we need to solve. You need some sort of anti-gravity outside of the ship. That's the bigger problem than getting gravity on the ship.
I mean, you might be able to use weird warp field geometry to sort of create artificial gravity that doesn't travel as far.
Create like a circular warp bubble around your ship so that stuff doesn't propagate.
Yeah, but then God help you if the warp field collapses.
Yeah.
You've suddenly introduced a second Earth right next to the original.
Is that such a bad thing? I like second Earths.
I think the tides might have something to say about, like, where you live. And where I live.
Fair
and
enough.
And where a large percentage of the population lives.
Yes, that's fair. So, Alex.
Yes, Kevin.
There is a new Raspberry Pi.
I know, I want one.
I want 500 of them.
What would you do with 500 of them, Kevin?
Everything.
Everything. So you'd build a warp bubble with it?
Yes.
Okay.
So the Raspberry Pi is a $5 computer.
Yes.
That's insane. And they're giving it away on the cover of magazines for fun.
Yeah, but the magazine does cost more than $5.
Yes, so. But no, so the Raspberry Pi is this hobbyist, very, very tiny computer. It's got, exposed circuitry and stuff if you're interested in playing with it. And it's roughly equivalent to a machine from, say the early 2000s, somewhere around there, as far as
performance. Yeah, early to mid-2000s.
You can run Linux. I think they were playing with running some version of Windows on there.
Yeah, there is an ARM build of Windows that has been booted on the Raspberry Pi. I don't know how it performs or does anything. Mm-hmm. I do think Windows or Microsoft itself was working on developing that, so it should be pretty good.
So, we both have Raspberry Pis.
Yep, right? Absolutely.
I've got one of there's a version 1 and a version 2, and then there were two different form factors of those. I've got one of each version.
So you have 4?
I just have the Bs.
Version 1B and version 2B. B1, B2.
Yeah. Man, I want a 0, though.
Okay, give me a use case, because I have one thing that I'd like to build with a 0. Name me some 500 things you'd like to build with your 0s.
See, the thing is, for me, it's not just the price, but it's also the form factor.
Yeah, the form factor is awesome.
It is smaller than a credit card. It's insane.
It's like the size of the mag stripe on your credit card. I mean, like double the mag stripe on your credit card, and now you've got the Pi Zero, basically.
Yeah, it is insanely small. And just for me, like, the idea is, like, I could... Actually, I'll tell you what I would really, really like to do with the Raspberry Pi, and this is with any Raspberry Pi. I haven't figured out a way to make it really work well, but I would love to be able to set up a Raspberry Pi with a really decent battery and a headset and then, like, a handheld keyboard.
Okay.
And then just have a portable work machine that I can fit kind of in my pocket.
So you want to make like a smartphone, the Kevin phone, with no cellular phone technology.
I don't want it to be a cell phone, because cell phone operating systems are dumb, and I want it to be a real computer. I want to be able to type full QWERTY on it and, you know, do things at a reasonable speed. I mean, because you can take the Raspberry Pi now and just plug in a keyboard and a mouse and a monitor and do that sort of thing. But I would really love to just say, I'm going on a work trip. I'm just going to slide this little wallet-sized thing into my pocket. Now I've got a reasonable enough machine to do stuff with.
No, okay, I get that. My suggestion to you is to look at the Ubuntu phone and a Bluetooth QWERTY keyboard.
I don't want to carry a keyboard around.
Wait, but how would you input to your Raspberry Pi then?
I'm thinking something like the Twiddler.
Oh, okay.
That I could get used to. And the thing is that if I were to carry on a Raspberry Pi and get, you know, a decent battery for it, the other thing, and there's not a wireless version of this, which frustrates me, but I would want to have like a VR style headset, something like Google Glass-ish.
You could get the Oculus and then tuck tape Elite Motion to the front of it. I've seen people, I just went to a game tech demo last night where someone was working on an augmented reality system where it was literally Elite Motion, which is a stereo camera that's used mostly for like hand tracking, but you can actually pull the raw camera data out of it. And it was duct taped to the front of an Oculus Rift. And then you had like this really beefy gaming computer plugged in that would process the data and added like these VR overlays. And it had like this like touchscreen operating system. It was basically like Minority Report, except you had to wear this horrible goggle thing to use it.
See, that's the thing, is I would prefer something that is kind of more like Google Glass. I feel really bad about Google Glass because it should have been really awesome.
I agree. And they're still working on it. The next version will hopefully be better.
Yeah.
The next version after that will even be better.
Yeah. I don't know.
Be a tech optimist.
The thing is, it was a closed platform. That was the big...
Was it? They had a developers conference about it.
Yeah, but it was still... I mean, it was not open in the... Yeah, go and hack all your stuff. I mean, they had... You were able to build apps for it.
Oh, okay, that's true. You had to use their specific APIs and... Yeah, okay.
Right. I want something... So, one of the other things that's notable about the Raspberry Pi is not just that it's this really cool, tiny computer, but that it's an open specification.
Yeah.
That we have this idea of open source software, which is, you know, here's all of the source code. You can go ahead and change anything that you want and go nuts. Open source hardware is this sort of same idea that here is exactly the step... here are exactly the steps that you need to take to build this thing. And, you know, we also are making them. If you want to buy them, that's great, too. But here you go.
It's a very attractive model.
Yeah, I mean, it's harder to monetize.
Yeah, but that's not their goal.
Right.
I don't know how the Pi Foundation actually makes that much money at all, to be honest.
I don't know. I mean, I would think that the manufacturing, that enough people end up buying their stuff to make it worthwhile. But I could be wrong. But the thing is that there's not really an... I would love for Google Glass to have been some sort of equivalent. And it really wasn't. There's not a big, like, here's an open idea for how to have, you know, basically glasses, but with a little display you can wear that's not going to... It's not going to cover your face. It's not going to be VR. It's just going to be a monitor that you can carry around with you. That is convenient. That's what I want. I want to be able to take the Raspberry Pi Zero. I want to be able to take a Bluetooth handheld full keyboard and mouse combo thing. And I want to be able to wear a headset that gives me a little display. And we'd be able to, you know, I could walk around and use a full computer just fine.
So, it's interesting. We were just having a discussion about this at lunch. Those displays do exist in very niche markets. So there's like one that you can use for skiing and snowboarding that's like built into the helmet. And it's really not like a huge thing, but it's just a very niche thing. There's a cycling computer, so cyclists can get updated data on how they're cycling through very, very similar prismed like displays that Google used for their class.
Mm.
It's just there's no open, like, you can do whatever. You can install this app if you want it to be a cycling computer. You can install this app if you want it to be your snowboarding computer, where it's very, very targeted towards a particular use case.
Right. I mean, at this early stage, most of the people are both building the hardware and then writing the software for it.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a precursor to things eventually being more open. Right. That until something takes off, it really doesn't make sense to go, all right, let's clean up our code base and try and make sure that this thing can be used by everybody and everybody can hack on it and do whatever they want.
Yeah. I mean, I will point out that people have been trying to build things like you are describing for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
The big issue is, I think, the display. Because people can put, you can put a laptop in your backpack if you wanted to have more compute power.
Yeah. The thing is, laptops are still way too heavy. I don't... Mm.
No, but people have been putting laptops in their backpacks. And they've been using those single-hand keyboard-mouse combos.
Mm-hmm.
And you can have headphones really easy, but having the display is the hard bit. And there just isn't a good display option for traveling around. You either have to hold something up to your face, or you have to have these weird bulky goggles that just don't quite work.
The thing that kind of confuses me, though, is that there's not really a... Like, because phones and tablets already would... I mean, if you duct taped one to the side of your face... You'd have a large version of what I want, especially with things like Chrome Remote Desktop or just VNC clients or things like that. You can have a display that's not going to update at the same refresh rate that you'd expect a regular machine to, but fast enough that for on the go, that's perfect. And yeah, if I want to sit down and work for a while, I can go ahead and plug the thing in, but there's not really a restriction on being able to broadcast stuff wireless, being able to broadcast a display's worth of information wirelessly.
Yeah, I mean, again, you're talking about perhaps building your own hardware. I'm sure there's like manufacturers in China who build those little prism displays.
Hmm?
You could probably get your hands on the little prism display and then hook it up to one of those Pi Zeros.
Hmm?
You have one Pi Zero on the side of your head and then have it wirelessly talk to, well, actually, you just have the Pi Zero on the side of your head. I don't know how you power it. Power is the big problem, I would think.
Yeah, power is particularly tricky, in particular for the display. You can get reasonable sized batteries that'll power your Raspberry Pi for, you know, a day.
Oh yeah, but sticking them to the side of your head, that's not going to be a fun proposition. You'd have to have like a wire going down the back of your shirt, maybe to a fanny pack. You have a
There is a version of like a Raspberry Pi version of Google Glass, and it uses the S video out on the old Raspberry Pi, and it is that it's just a whole bunch of wires, you know, gone down and it's not what I want.
Mean, how would you propose to power this then? Like, because you want something on the side of your head, do you want the batteries on the side of your head? Because the only other thing is you have a wire that goes to the side of your head.
The thing that I really want is, you remember how exciting it was when USB drives were a thing?
Yes.
That all of a sudden, you could walk around with information?
Yep.
That wasn't the case, and it's a really stupid distinction. Because especially when we were talking about USB drives that were smaller than 80 megs... A CD was better than a USB drive everybody's computer could deal with it. If it was audio, you could play it in a CD player. USB drives, some people didn't have USB ports or didn't have any, or had broken them by inserting them the wrong way because USB hadn't fixed that.
Go USB 3.
Right.
C.
Right. But it was really, really cool in that basically, you know, I can put a video on my keychain. I still every time there's a new USB drive, I want to know what the largest thing is. It makes me really sad about how much money I've spent on small USB drives comparatively. But
I have two. How many do you have?
I think I've got three.
Oh, okay. That's not that bad.
No, I don't buy them, but I go and I just ogle them And I may get another one, but we're up to like a terabyte and a half now, I think. Far as like just commercially available and not more than $2,000. But the thing that I really want is I want to have a fully functional computer that I can carry around with me. And a phone should be that, but a phone very much isn't that. Because Apple, and Google, and Microsoft, and BlackBerry.
So, I have a coworker who has an Android phone. He only really ever uses one app on it, and that's the terminal app that he uses to SSH back into his home computer. Mm-hmm. And he does everything through the command line. And he has a little QWERTY keyboard that he has in a case that is just stuck to the phone. Mm-hmm. It literally is glued to the phone. So he's always just typing on that little QWERTY keyboard.
But the display is a problem.
Oh, I agree. It's not.
If I could have, maybe that is just the right approach. Is that it is just find the most foldable Bluetooth keyboard. And then just find some way to hold the phone nearer to your face while you type. Because that's the problem with that idea is that, you know, if you're looking at a tablet type of device, then yeah, the screen resolution is large enough that it can sit near your keyboard. The problem with a phone is that it's too small to be used at arm's length.
Well, yes and no. I suppose. I mean, it depends on how large your phone screen is.
Right. Well, that's the other thing. As I want a phone that would fit. I have big pockets. I'm a large man.
Yes.
And phones don't fit in a lot of... Like what is... Why... I don't understand the large phone revolution.
Really? Okay, so I don't have any problem putting my phone in my pocket. And I have the iPhone 6S Plus, which is the big iPhone. Because I don't like iPads.
Do you realize they still sell iPhone 4s? No, like the nice small iPhone 4s that were like a good form factor for a phone?
I mean, I do, but I can do a ton of stuff on my phone. I use my phone almost as much as I do my laptop for like getting actual things done.
Yeah, see, that doesn't make any sense at all. You're talking nonsense. But,
you're trying to describe a system by which you can do exactly that same thing. I can leave my laptop at home, take my phone, and go on a business trip, and be fine.
No, you can't. You can't, no.
What can't I do?
You can't write Python code efficiently, or whatever code you're writing.
I mean, I can type pretty fast. And there's actually a pretty good Python interpreter for iPhone. You can do Python development on iPhone. And if I can't do Python development, or if I can't do some particular language development, then I just pop open an SSH, and I do my C++ development remotely.
Okay, well, for one thing, you don't get a full keyboard.
Yeah, I guess you do.
No, you don't. You don't get the escape key, you don't get your function keys, you don't have...
Okay, that's true.
I mean, and that actually does become a limitation in a lot of circumstances. The other thing, and part of this is because I do web development, I need to know what a site is going to look like in other form factors as well.
Then you VNC into your desktop.
So this solution is the same as saying, because I don't want to have to lug my piano keyboard around, I'm going to get a small thing that has 5 keys and a shift up by 5 keys and shift down by 5 keys button.
Yeah.
And then just loop the stuff back over and over. And then I can totally play the piano just fine.
I mean, yeah, it's very simpler. I would agree with that. But there are cases when you don't want to lug a laptop around. There are cases when you don't want to lug a piano around, and you'd like to have at least, you know, limited access to everything that you want to play with. Right. Maybe you're working on some composition and you just need a small range of keys to try to work something out, you know, how it transitions if you want to throw in a grace note here or something like that. And this is a very similar situation where you can get work done. It's not going to be as fast. It's not going to be as efficient.
It's going to be incredibly painfully slow. It's going to, in the same order of magnitude of, yes, I'm going to go ahead and play The Entertainer on a 5-key MIDI controller.
I thought you didn't like Maple Leaf Rag or The Entertainer. I thought you hated those.
I'm not a fan of Joplin, but... Eh. I think it's, I don't know. It's maybe that they're just too overplayed, but still, I mean, but you get my point though, is that it is just so slow a device, and it feels like there's gotta be some way to make things more portable.
I think you should try to source one of those Google Glass prisms and just hot glue it to a pair of sunglasses and attach your Raspberry Pi Zero to the side of the sunglasses. And I think you'd have a pretty interesting experience. So what I want to do with the Pi Zero is I want to super glue like 4 or 6 servos. I forget how many legs spiders have. I want to glue 6 spider legs onto the side with servos. I want to put a web server on it. So then I would have a web spider and it could crawl the web and be a web server and crawl around. That was my genius invention for the Pi Zero.
I don't have anything to say to you.
Excellent, I win.
I was thinking about what my first computer was like. Not my first, I mean the family computer, the first one that I remember was like. And I think the hard drive was something like, I don't know, 512 meg, which was enormous. And of course, this was before Windows 3.
Ugh.
I think. I mean, it could be, or it could be we just hadn't bought it at the time. So, I mean, we were running stuff on DOS.
Yeah.
And floppy disks were the coolest thing in the world.
Yeah, they were. I remember when floppy disks were really cool.
Floppy disks are so awesome, man. They're still really cool. I don't care what anybody says. Floppy disks are amazing.
But, like, you'd still buy a high-end computer and it would have a floppy disk drive. And it was just the coolest. It would span... It was just the coolest. It would spin at like 30,000 RPM or whatever floppy drives spin at. I don't know. It'd be great. It'd be really fast.
I had to look it up because I was sure like they must have expanded the size of floppy drives. I think it's a...
They got smaller over time.
No, right. But I assumed that their capacities had to have gotten larger. But no, it was 1.44, kind of their entire lifespan. I look now, I'm like, a thumbnail for a YouTube video is more than that.
Yeah.
And my dad had this whole collection that me and my siblings raided of just Apogee DOS games.
Yeah.
And that sort of thing. And I am absolutely certain that I've written far more than 1.44 megabytes of just text source code.
Oh, absolutely, I'm sure.
Easily. The idea that you could create an entire game in less than that, I'm infuriated and embarrassed that we're taking so much more space now when we shouldn't have to. That the limitation of file size really inspired a lot of very clever techniques for optimization that we just don't have anymore. And I wonder to what extent we're creating kind of bloated programs now just because we're not concerned with those sorts of limitations.
Right. I mean, we've discussed this in one of my more advanced algorithms classes. And basically what the conclusion was is really try to design your algorithms for your speed, because space complexity is depending on your implementation. You can just throw RAM at it. So it's not unreasonable to get a system with a terabyte of RAM in a research space, right? So if your algorithm is really space inefficient but can do it really, really fast, then it's a solvable problem on even a small scale. Like, a terabyte of RAM isn't what it used to be.
I don't know that I agree. So
it's context sensitive. I'll give you that. It's context sensitive, but it's becoming more and more frequent that you can just add more storage really cheap.
Right. But I think there's a third thing to optimize. I mean, because, yeah, you're writing, I mean, at least academically, when people are talking about computer software, there are kind of those two aspects that you factor in, is that how much space is this going to take? How large is this thing going to be? And how fast will it run? And those are kind of the two things and the trade-off, and those are the two factors. and you just pick which one you want to care about.
Oh, you can care about both of them. There are diagrams you can have linear space complexity and linear time.
Right. But those are the two things that get measured, and they have their own notations for measuring them based on the complexity of the problem that they're trying to solve and that sort of thing. There's a third one, though, that I think, and it certainly doesn't matter at all in an academic context, but I think matters far more than those two in any practical context,
mm-hmm.
and that is the comprehensibility ability to and affordance of modification, the extent to which you can understand what a program is doing, what the code is doing,
right.
and the extent to which you can change it rapidly.
Yeah, no, I'll give you that. But say calculating primes, or you know, but you can have like very large programs that take a very large amount of time. Like you could inefficiently calculate prime factors, which can grow exponentially in both cost and or speed and size costs, mm-hmm. and it can be like three lines that's very easy to understand,
right?
And very easy to change.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know.
But then I mean, and yeah, then you're sacrificing because it's just that generally the idea is that you want to have fast performance and you want to have. You want to have, you know, small storage requirements, and those are the two things that you're trying to optimize for, kind of from an academic perspective. I think there's and this is kind of a big thing now that functional programming is really sort of taking off. The idea that you're programming things by setting up these functions that are these boxes that take something in and spit something out, and they don't do anything other than that. And that programming is really just a matter of organizing those boxes in a reasonable way. Functional programming was kind of discarded for being an incredibly stupid and inefficient way to do any sort of programming.
Yeah. It's been around a long time.
Yeah. But it was discarded mostly because of memory. Because memory was very expensive. Now, memory is very cheap. So, that's less of an issue. But it wasn't ever the fast. It's very rarely the fastest way to do something either.
Yeah.
So to even consider functional programming, you have to assume that there is some third factor that outweighs the performance and space requirements. That if your goal in writing good programs is to make it fast and small, and if functional programming is taken off as an alternative. And it is not fast and not small. There's got to be some other motivation for doing that.
It's an elegance factor. It's an elegant way of writing things in some cases. Now, don't get me wrong. Not every functional programming, you know, piece of code is an elegant solution. But it can have some very elegant components about it. And can write some things that you would describe as beautiful code.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can do that without functional programming as well, but yeah. I've seen a lot of...
I've never really seen procedural code.
I don't know. Some recursion. Recursion. I like recursion.
That's not procedural. You can't have procedural recursion. That doesn't work. Yeah. But recursion is a functional thing, really.
Yeah, you're right. They kind of stole that.
What? They didn't steal... No.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess if you consider, like, if and go to, then sure, you can consider it stolen. But really, it's more accurate to say the functional programming came up with recursion, and it was repurposed
for everything
else.
Yeah, and then it was stolen by, it was stolen one direction or another.
But I agree with you that I think a lot of functional code is really, really beautiful. But I don't think that's why it is taken off, and I don't think that's why it should be successful.
No, yeah.
The reason that functional programming is a really great idea, and the problem is that this doesn't make academic sense. This is kind of like how economists assume that everyone is a rational actor with perfect information.
Yeah.
And then people buy things they don't need for no reason and make all the economists mad.
Like 500 pi zeros, perhaps?
Right. I mean, from a rational perspective, all of our programs should be written in ones and zeros in the most efficient way possible. And there are some times where you can't, where you are in a position of a direct trade-off between space and performance time, between space and speed, and you can then make the decision, all right, we're going to take more space so that we can do it faster, we're going to run slower so we can save space. Yep. Functional programming does not optimize for either of those things. What it does do is it forces the program author to create very small units of code.
Okay.
That do almost nothing.
Almost.
I mean, really, they do almost nothing. And if you're making super complex functions, then it's not generally a pure function. It's generally stateful, and it's going to break stuff. And the thing about that is then it becomes incredibly easy to swap out any of those functions. What you're effectively doing when you're doing functional programming is you're making a sculpture out of Legos, and if one Lego doesn't work, you can just get a different Lego and swap it out.
If one Lego turns into a Duplo or a Mega Block, then you just get rid of it. It's useless.
Well, I mean, the problem is that you have... So, I'm always so nervous when we talk about code. In my mind, okay. I'm like listening to like other people going, oh, what the hell is that?
This is literally called the Code Monkey Podcast. If we don't talk about code, if we don't feel comfortable talking about code, why have we called our podcast this?
I don't know. I know.
I think it's much easier for us to talk about space because we actually don't know anything about it. And we're just making it up. Whereas where we feel like we should know something about code and computer science-y stuff, and it's just harder to just freeform talk about it because we're afraid we'll say something wrong and it'll affect us in some way.
I do know stuff about code. I don't know.
I kind of do.
So, Alex, the United States government has passed into law the right to explore and exploit asteroids for commercial purposes.
I think we should start a new company.
Okay. We'll call it Puzzles.
Puzzles?
Yes.
I think it should say something with asteroids.
People will be like, why is it called Puzzle?
It's a puzzle.
There you go.
Okay. I can get on board with that. Especially if we build rocket ships. And I can get really on board a puzzle rocket ship. And we can go and claim these asteroids for ourselves.
I would very much like to mine/own it. Actually, so I would like to go out and I imagine I'm going to make a future prediction. Alex, I know that's your thing, but I'm gonna predict the future.
I'll let you have the amphitheater.
All right. I think that eventually people will live in asteroids like the asteroids will be the log cabins of the future.
I have a prediction for the future.
All right.
I predict you're wrong.
That's not surprising.
We'll see who's right in 5,000 years.
But wouldn't that be just the most awesome thing? Basically, you know, you can be like Space Thoreau.
So the big problem I have is gravity. There is none, or very little.
Yeah, but if you never plan on leaving, that's fine.
Well, is it fine? Like, your body goes all weird, and we're not certain that people can live long term without gravity.
Yeah, no, that's...
They might have drastically reduced lifespan.
That's true, so, and I think there's probably... It's probably one of those things we won't really know for...
Ever.
Yeah, I want to say ever, but I don't really know. You know, obviously right now we've got two astronauts in space that are spending a year on the ISS so that we can figure out, are they going to die when they come back? But even then, it's only a little bit longer than many of the astronauts have already been on the ISS.
Well, and there've been cosmonauts, I think, that have been up there for a year, up in space for a year already.
Or, is that true?
I think.
On Mir?
I don't know.
Well, and there's certainly been astronauts that have been in space more than a year, just not in sequence. Right. I don't know if there have been. I mean, it's possible that some of the Russian cosmonauts on the pre-ISS.
So there's a Russian astronaut, Valery Polyakov.
Valery.
Who is... Valery. Okay. So there's a Russian astronaut, Valery Polyakov, who has spent 437.7 days in space. He launched on January the 9th, 1994, and he didn't land until March the 22nd, 1995. He spent that duration on Mir.
Yep, okay.
In fact, it doesn't happen until Scott Kelly is currently tied with a Russian astronaut at 239 days.
Well, that's because they're both in space doing the exact same thing.
Yeah, yes.
I mean, they went up on the same day.
Yeah, so they're tied at number seven. So even when they spend their whole year in space, they'll still be like 100 days short of the current Russian record.
Right. But I think, certainly it'd be fascinating to find out, but I imagine that, well, I don't know. Can you imagine like maybe one of, like maybe John Glenn or something is just like, I'll just go up until I'm not around anymore. That sounds bad.
Well,
I mean, can you imagine though at some point, like one, you know, someone who just really, that there would be some point at which, I don't know. I mean, maybe that's just, it's too much of a PR issue.
Your sample size is way too small. Well, yeah, sample size would be too small.
Right. But I'm just saying from the perspective of trying to get information on very long periods in space, that basically there might at some point be an astronaut who's, you know, basically ready to retire, you know, doesn't necessarily have family ties or something like that, but is willing to say, yeah, I will go up in space and just remain in space indefinitely. I think the problem is that you can't, it becomes a huge PR.
I'm not sure problem. What type of data we'd get from that either. Well, I mean, beyond like the long term, like how long, like if he lived for another 5 years, then of course you'd have 5 years of space-like data.
Right. Well, I'm not saying like you put them up and then you go, I wonder if they'll die or not, because obviously they will if it's indefinite.
Maybe that's the key to living forever.
You can track things like bone density loss over extended periods of time, which is the biggest. Oh. I think probably the biggest thing that that they're concerned
about.
But
even then, it's one person.
Right.
People have varying bone densities all over the place.
Right. Like, but you still, all of science happens one experiment at a time. I'm not.
Well, right, one experiment, but an experiment can have like a large number of subjects in it.
Right.
We really need to send like 20 up and let them all just fade out.
No. See. I'm just saying that it would be fascinating to find out that if you stay in space indefinitely, for one person, their bone density shrank to 70% of normal and then stopped shrinking. Like, that would be fascinating.
Yeah.
Like, even if they were an outlier. You know, sure, I would still find that to be very useful information.
No, it would be very interesting. Yeah,
but I don't think you're ever going to, at least certainly within our lifetimes, I don't think there's ever going to be a mission that we feel has serious risks for the astronauts' return.
That
basically, we're never going to go say, you know, spend 5 years on the ISS and then, we're not sure if you'll be able to survive back on Earth again. We're looking to find out. Let's go do that experiment. Whereas it would be possible maybe to send up someone who is comfortable with the idea of not returning.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I would. Like, I'd be okay dying in space, you know? Be like, I'm 80 years old. We'll just go up to space.
Right.
See what happens.
But I also don't know. That may just be like a, like the idea of someone dying. I mean, no one has died in the ISS. Maybe that's a record they want to keep. It's very, very sad and very, very challenging when that happens for people. And when it happens, in particular with space flight, you know, obviously it's with NASA already having trouble with, you know, image and budget and that sort of thing. It may just be the sort of thing they can't afford to do, even if, you know, one of the astronauts is perfectly willing.
Yeah, I mean, and the space station right now, I think, is currently scheduled to deorbit sometime in the 2020s. 2030s, maybe?
I'm not sure. I think it's in the 2020s, so I think that may be contingent upon whether the successor ends up getting pushed forward, because that's still somewhat up in the air.
Yeah.
Oh, all right. Man.
No.
But I think the information we would want to have, right, is a 30 to 40 year old person goes to space and stays there for 10 years. Can they come back to Earth? That's the thing that really we would want to know, right?
I mean, what I want to know is I want to take like 10 sets of identical twins, send one set, like one group of 10 to the International Space Station at birth, and keep one set on Earth.
Oh, at birth?
And at birth, and then track the changes. I think that would be a really cool... Like, obviously you can't ever do that. You can't ever do this.
Right.
It's totally inhuman. Well, I mean, it'd be an interesting experiment, though. It's an interesting thought experiment, I would think, for the medical community.
Well, that's the thing that I think is really, really challenging when we talk about interstellar travel or even colonizing Mars or that sort of thing, is that there is no way to know ahead of time. Because certainly with interstellar travel, we're talking about, you know, barring things like the warp drive, we're talking about multi-generational craft. There is no way to find out what's going to happen to a person if they are born in space without having a person be born in space, which is, and there's a big question with regard to nature and nurture, and there's a big psychological experiment that every psychologist would love to do, can never be done, that is to raise someone in a deprivation chamber, have someone be born in a deprivation chamber and study how they turn out. There unfortunately have been some people who have been severely isolated due to familial abuse and that sort of thing, and they have made, there's been some research that's been gleaned from that information, but obviously it's never something that you would, you know, intentionally do in a controlled environment.
Right.
And I do sort of wonder, how do we ever have, you know, even if we find out, you know, or even if it is true that you can be born in space, no problems, you're totally fine, how are we ever going to know that? Will we ever know that?
I mean, at some point, you're going to have a generational craft. I think that is something that we will run into at some point. We'll see some meteor. We'll finally, like, figure something out.
I mean, yeah, if we're talking about the annihilation of the Earth, then yeah, I agree.
I think at some point, we're just going to have to do it for one reason or another. Either we decide it's the best course of action, or we decide it's the only course of action, and we're just going to do it, and then we'll know. But yeah, I don't think it's unethical. Unethical? I think it's unethical to really run a lot of these experiments, obviously.
Right.
And so you're kind of right that someday we're going to have to do the thing that we can't have the experience from having previous experiments of.
The same reasons to not test are the same reasons to just not do it.
But I think the costs at some point will be outweighed by the benefits, like in a disaster scenario.
Right. In a disaster scenario, then yeah, we get everybody that, you know, we'll send up every really crappy, untested, probably going to explode rocket we can find.
Yeah.
And pack as many people in there without spacesuits because we need the, you know, they're too heavy. In a disaster scenario, throw as much stuff up as you possibly can. But barring that, basically, I think what has to happen, and I'm thinking more about Mars because, you know, there are talks about colonizing it maybe within our lifetimes, though there have been talks about colonizing Mars within our lifetimes for, you know, our parents' lifetimes.
Yeah.
But I think what has to happen is something like the Mars colony, the people who volunteered for a one-way trip. What has to happen is two of them have to have a kid without permission, without anybody tacitly agreeing. And then we go, wow, we didn't expect this and we don't condone it, but now we know. Like, it's a terrible thing.
Right.
And it would also be very, very reasonable to bring both parents up on charges for that. You know, I mean, it's an inexcusable, irresponsible thing to do, but I don't know how else, I don't know.
Short of accidentally or with great peril, or, you know, where the benefits outweigh the horrible costs,
mm-hmm.
you know, doomsday scenario type things.
Yeah. I mean, you can even pull it back even further. There's been, you know, NASA has a very strict no sex in space policy.
Although I think they have designed spacesuits for it.
What? Really?
I do. I do think they've contemplated what it would look like. And how they would build
I mean, I know they've done research on how that could possibly happen. The problem is, if I remember right, I think Mary Roach talked about this a little bit in her book Packing for Mars, but she talked about there was some research that was done, and then some reporter found out about it, and then all of America was mad about their tax dollars, and so they stopped. And kind of since then, NASA's had this whole, nope, nothing happens, nothing has happened, nothing ever happened, nope, not our thing.
Yeah.
And I think it's probably the case that, you know, NASA will never, ever encourage people to have sex in space. They will never go, okay, well, your science duties for today are...
Yeah, absolutely.
Basically, the only way that we're going to find out if that is possible is if two astronauts go rogue, which also has an incredible risk of them losing their jobs.
It would be a terrible action movie, two astronauts go rogue. Oh,
I mean, it's a uniquely challenging problem, though, because you're the Wright brothers, you're making an airplane, and it's probably going to kill first person who flies it. Well, that's fine. You can fly it. You're trying out some vaccine that requires exposure to a virus. You can try it on yourself. These things have been done in the past, and we don't, we don't revile the doctor for trying some experiment on themselves because, you know, they felt it, you know, there was great need for it. But the problem is that in this case, you're not the one who is at risk.
Ah, however, you could clone yourself, and therefore you'd be giving birth to yourself, and therefore you would be the only person at risk.
Yeah, that's not how that works.
Dang it. Thought I'd solve this ethical quandary. There was another crazy Martian mission that was explored by some company, where the idea was to send literally just two people on a 500 or so day free return trip to Mars. So it would be, they would get a married couple, and they would put them on a free return orbit to Mars and back. It wouldn't actually stop at Mars. I think it was just to see what would happen.
Right.
But I think the intention...
I would predict divorce.
Yeah, probably. I mean, it's 500 days, it's a year and a half. You could probably go off to your own separate corners of the spaceship for that. And, you know, I don't know. I'm not married. I can't really comment on this.
Right.
But yeah, short of that, I don't know.
I mean, but I don't know. It's just kids in space. It's so weird.
We really
there's
just
no way to know if, there's no way to know if it's possible without trying it, and trying it is the most unethical. Words. So I have a confession to make.
Uh oh.
I've started playing Euro Truck Simulator 2.
What? How is this a confession? And are you ashamed of this knowledge?
Yes, I'm very ashamed of this.
Why?
You're driving a truck.
Yes.
In Europe.
Yeah, but Kevin, you will never actually drive a truck in Europe, right? You don't have a driver's license. You would never spontaneously go to Europe and drive a truck. So you're doing something.
I would
something
spontaneously would... go to Europe.
Well, but I said spontaneously go to Europe and drive a truck. It would fail Boolean algebra. Come on. Anyway, point of the matter is you're doing something that you wouldn't normally do. That's exactly what video games are supposed to let you experience, right?
But what is embarrassing is how much I enjoy this game. It's not a game.
I mean, it can be.
No.
Make a game out of it. You could play, like, I don't know, all those silly, like, car driving games while playing it. Like, have to I spy with my little eye something green.
Oh, God.
The Interstate 57 sign. Although it's Euro Truck. I don't know if they don't have interstates, obviously. What do they have? I don't know.
So here's the thing that I noticed while playing this game. So you know how the UK makes fun of the US for, you know, not liking the metric system?
Oh, they use miles.
Being generally... Right. One, they use miles. But worse than that, they're the only place in Europe that drives down the left side of the road.
Yeah, you have these really cool interchanges when you go from the UK and some of the left hand of the road driving people and to a right handed steering systems, you have these weird, like, complex, like, interchanges as you cross, like, country borders. Mm. It's great.
See, it just, because when I was a kid, I assumed it was a, you know, U.S. versus Europe thing. No, it's just the U.K.
Oh, yeah.
They're the only ones with that stupid, and why? It seems more irresponsible than us liking Fahrenheit. It seems way more irresponsible. Because you're bound to screw it up at some point if you ever leave the continent or travel.
There's some British colonies that also do it that way, or former British colonies, I should say.
Oh, are there?
Yeah. Like, is India on the other side of the road too?
I'm not sure.
I definitely, there are some African countries that I think used to be long, long ago British colonies that drive on the left-hand side of the road. In Europe, I think you're probably right that it's just the UK. But I think the UK has had its influence in other parts of the world.
Well, the other thing, though, that I noticed, and this could just be that this is the way the Euro Truck Simulator works. Well, actually, no, because you mentioned that there are these exchange lanes. You set up the car with the driver's side facing the opposite side.
Yeah.
What they ought to do is, if they're going to continue with this really stupid system, is force you to not take your car off of the island, and vice versa.
I mean, it's totally legal for you to drive a British-made car here in the United States. You can register.
Is it?
Yeah. Yeah.
It shouldn't be.
Is Japan on the other side of the road, too? I feel like Japan is as well.
It's a really stupid, I mean, for a country that is small and proximate to other countries, it should stop. If I mix up Fahrenheit and Celsius, what's the worst thing that's going to happen? Not that I drive on the wrong side of the road and kill people. That's not what's going to happen by using a different unit for the temperature.
Yeah, so if you mix up metric and imperial, then your spacecraft will accidentally burn up in the atmosphere of Mars.
My unmanned spacecraft.
Well, I mean, the only thing that makes a manned spacecraft versus an unmanned spacecraft is whether there's a person on it. So it could have happened.
Exactly. There are people in cars, Alex. For now. There are people in cars.
For now. And there's no people on Mars-bound spacecrafts. For now. Eventually,
exactly.
There may be Mars-bound spacecrafts.
So eventually we should convert to metric. But right now, we should stop driving on the wrong side of the road.
Do you realize what the infrastructure cost would be to rip up all the left-hand sides and make them right-hand sides?
Alex, if it saves just one life.
But I'm arguing that maybe we should do it the other way around. Why should it be that way?
If you're trying to argue cost, then there are more people driving on the right. There are more countries with right-hand rule than left-hand rule.
That is not true. So India, Japan, Australia, most of southern Africa, and the UK. There's a lot of people in those countries.
So India is the only one with a lot of people.
Australia is large,
they have and they have the population of South Dakota. There's like no one there.
Yeah, but just think of all the roads that must be crisscrossing.
They landed and decided we're not going any further inland. This is way too scary already.
But think of all the roads that must be crisscrossing through the middle of nowhere. You have to rip those all up? It's dangerous. You have to go inland? Just think of all the people who would die trying to change out the roads in Australia alone.
Well, no, this is something like I really would like to know, and I don't know if anybody records this, but I would really like to know how many deaths can be attributed to wrong side of the road driving after travel or that sort of thing. You know, I doubt that it's something that's... maybe it is something that, like, the UK border
parliament tracks. It's an island, Kevin. There's no inner... How would the UK... You're not going to drive your car off of the UK. You have to go through a ferry.
If they track... You know, I don't know. I would not be surprised to find that there are more accidents centered around the Channel and the various ferries than elsewhere in the country.
Can you drive through the Channel? I thought that was only
no,
a train.
You can. It is a train, but you can drive onto the train and then you can transport. There are car transports, I believe.
Oh, okay.
It's just like a very, very long car wash.
Yeah. Hopefully not as wet.
Right. Well, ideally, yeah. But I would not be surprised to find that there are more wrong side of the road accidents around those areas. And I'd be interested to know. Maybe there are stats on that.
I mean, yeah, I don't know.
If it saves one life, Alex.
If it saves one life, we should all just stay cuddled up in a ball in the corner of our room. I mean, we'd save lives that way.
We would kill lives that way, too.
Well, I think all the confused British people, they might accidentally drive on the wrong side of the road after you've changed their roads around. They just wake up one morning and all their roads are reversed. Think of the chaos.
If you imagine, like, New Jersey decided, we're going to go left-hand side like, tomorrow.
Well, yeah.
That would probably be a much bigger disaster than any European country
switching. They could
switching.
Do it, too. States have enough control. Exactly. I'm going to run for New Hampshire Senate now, and I'm going to mandate New Hampshire changes their road direction.